Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whenever you're listening, and welcome to Tri-State at the Plate. I'm your host, Andy Burdick, joined today by our super producer in between his daddy duties, Jason Ruggiero. Jason, how are you today?
Oh, it's good to be here. Good to be here.
It's always a pleasure to hear from you, good sir. Always a pleasure. So before we move on to the Pirates and Indians today, Jason, I wanted to talk about Max Scherzer. He's made some headlines recently. Scherzer recently signed a $210 million deal with the Washington Nationals. And I have to say it was one of the more interesting contracts I've ever seen. In fact, it was we had to kind of go through and rehash it before we recorded today.
To yes, make sure we had did.
All of our T's crossed and our I's dotted here. So, Jason, what's your take on this $210 million deal that Max Scherzer signed?
Well, okay, it's $210 million over 7 years of work, but a deferred signing bonus of $25 million for 7 years after the contract expires, correct?
Yeah, I mean, basically, he's getting paid. Half of his money over the 7 years that he's pitching
right.
Nationals.
It's a signing bonus of $50 million over 14 years, but the contract's 7 years. So half of that bonus, like you said, comes during those first 7 years while he's still pitching, and then half of it comes when he's in Florida or pitching for someone else.
Right. Yeah, I mean that's Ken Rosenthal tweeted out when the deal broke that Scherzer's deal with the Nationals is 7 years, $210 million with half deferred. He's going to receive $15 million per year for 14 years. Now, this was interesting. I took a look at a Deadspin article written by Tom Lay, who kind of suggested something that I hadn't really thought about but makes sense, which is that the $105 million in deferred money, if you think about it, is going to be less valuable than if he was getting it over the life of the contract because of inflation. So again, if you're looking at where players' salaries are going, specifically like ace pitchers like Clayton Kershaw and Max Scherzer and Felix Hernandez and pitchers of those ilk, they're only making more money. So, you know, in 10 years or whatever, that $15 million is probably going to be a little less, what I'm trying to say here. It's going to be a little less impressive than it seems right now, I guess.
That's true, except if you want to make this even more complicated, Washington, D.C. does not have a resident income tax. And Scherzer is planning at some point to move to Florida, where we know from like Giancarlo Stanton's contract, there is either very little or no income tax. So the idea being that the portion paid to him over the first 7 years does not have a serious tax levy, and the portion that is deferred over the last 7 years will not have a serious tax levy.
That's an interesting point. The taxes thing is something I always fail to remember, like Russell Martin going to Canada.
Right. Well, like, because we were just talking before we started about how this is the, it's really hard to put an exact calc on the value of the contract because of all this. But if you take MLB's taking the value as $185 million for luxury tax calculations. So if you take that, it's the second highest contract for a pitcher, only to Clayton Kershaw. But of course, Clayton Kershaw plays in Los Angeles, which is in California, which has a high income tax. So even though he has the highest contract, he's getting less of that money in his own pocket.
Very interesting point. Now, here's where we really need to start thinking about this from a baseball perspective. A 30-year-old pitcher who's who's throwing 200 innings like it's nobody's business season after season that signs a 7-year contract. How do you foresee this contract looking after about 4 or 5 years?
Well, Let me let's see here. MLB Trade Rumors has already rounded up a few of the people to compare him against who have signed 7-year contracts. Two of them are pretty recent, and one of these is for a much younger person, so we don't know how they panned out, Clayton Kershaw and Felix Hernandez. Okay, then you have CC Sabathia's 7-year deal.
Yeah, how'd that one turn out?
Which, without looking it up, I'm going to say Sabathia was of a similar age when he signed his. Well, that was good for maybe the first 2 years, but not so much anymore. Then you have Justin Verlander's extension, which tacked 5 years onto his existing contract and made it a 7-year contract. We know how Verlander struggled last year. And then you have Mr. Barry Zito.
I have to say, Jason, you are not inspiring a lot of confidence right now with this 7-year deal.
I mean, because Kershaw, wasn't he like pre-arbitration even when he signed his?
Yeah.
So you can't even count that. Okay, he's right. Like almost 6 years younger at least.
Yeah.
Felix is still pitching, so you know, we don't know how that's going to turn out. But the other three don't inspire very much confidence. And if you look at someone like Verlander and even CeCe, those were people that, like you said, they were always logging lots of innings, right? They were always that workhorse. Like Verlander, he was always 200 innings, 200 innings, 200 innings. And he just kind of fallen apart the last 2 years, really.
Yeah, you can watch the velocity steadily decline on his fastball, and thus the numbers are not nearly as impressive as they used to be.
So, with all that said, Andy, this is adding Max Scherzer not to, like, the rotation of the Los Angeles Angels, whom I can't even, like, name other than Garrett Richards or, I can't hardly think of anyone who's on their rotation. This is the Nationals rotation, which was already supposed to be one of the best around.
Right.
You had, of course, Steven Strasburg. You had Jordan Zimmermann, Gio Gonzalez, Doug Fister, Tanner Roark. So you're paying a ton of money, taking on a ton of liability for what really, for signing a top flight pitcher, is like a marginal upgrade.
I have to say, when Gio Gonzalez is your fifth starter, your rotation's pretty good. Your rotation's pretty good. You're doing okay for yourself.
I mean, well, did you remember a couple of years ago when the Phillies had like the was supposed to be the amazing rotation?
The Cliff Lee, Roy Halladay, Roy Oswalt. How many World Series titles are we going to win with these guys?
Yeah. Do you remember who was the fifth starter in that rotation?
I think about the Phillies' fifth starter.
You got three of the starters, right? You got Oswalt, Halladay, Lee.
Joe Blanton?
Joe Blanton was the fifth starter. And everyone was like, oh my God. And that year, Joe Blanton was a train wreck. Not that that means anything, you know,
right,
going
yeah.
forward. But it's just fun to remember that that rotation did not exactly work out the way they envisioned. I don't know. I just don't. I mean, just, now we're talking about trading Jordan Zimmermann or Steven Strasburg.
Yeah. I mean, you're assuming. I guess when I look at it just as an outsider, not a Nationals fan that, you know, is really reading tons of stuff about the Nationals, but I would assume that Tanner Roark is going to be the one that would be on his way out. And then you're featuring a rotation that top to bottom has, you know, I guess if you slot Max Scherzer in at number one, then Steven Strasburg is number two. And then Jordan Zimmermann, number three, Doug Fister, number four, and Gio Gonzalez, five. Or maybe you bump Gio Gonzalez up so you have a lefty, you know, breaking up the
right,
80s.
But I mean...
That's a nasty rotation.
Well, it's nasty. The speculation I've heard has basically been like, we've seen Doug Fister traded a couple times and no one ever seems to get true value for Doug Fister, so they're not going to trade Doug Fister.
Right.
And that Jordan Zimmermann has 1 year left on his contract, and we've seen what pitchers with 1 year left on their contract are worth, and they had all winter to try to trade Jordan Zimmermann, and that didn't seem to be gaining a whole lot of traction. And I don't think the reasoning is they don't want to trade Gio because he's left-handed. And so that leaves Roark and Strasburg.
I think it's kind of crazy to imagine a Steven Strasburg trade, but I don't know, man.
Think baseball. Think about what you could get in return.
Yeah. pretty much anything you want, I would assume.
Well, think about, I'm just going to throw this out there. I'm not saying this is going to happen. I'm not saying this. But what do the Nationals desperately need? Not pitching.
No, I mean, they need, I don't know, a center fielder.
Center fielder would be nice.
A middle infielder. I mean, I'm assuming
middle infielder.
Yunel Escobar out at second base at this point.
Right, and Ian Desmond's going to be a free agent at the end of the year. So if I'm Mike Rizzo, I might put in a call to the old Cleveland Indian tribe.
Oh, and it comes back to the tribe.
Hey there, Christopher. I see you've got a whole bunch of middle infielders, more than you actually got room to play on the diamond.
You dreamer.
And you've got yourself a center fielder that costs a fair amount and you'd like to unload.
Is this the kind of stuff you think about before you fall asleep at night? Is this the narrative that you've made up in your head?
Tell me that there's not some kind of connection there.
Listen, if I'm trading Steven Strasburg, we're starting at Chris Bryant, and then we're working our way from there. That's what...
You don't have Chris Bryant.
No, yeah. That's probably why I'm not going to be talking to the Indians. If I were talking to the Indians, we'd be starting at Francisco Lindor, and then we'd be working our way from there.
Right. That's what I'm saying.
But that would be a sexy trade, don't get me wrong. That would be a really sexy trade. That would keep our podcast in business all summer long, Jason.
I'm talking like Strasburg for Lindor, Born, and Giovanni Urshela and something else.
My interest would be piqued if I were the Nationals.
I'm just saying, right? If you're gonna sit on all these prospects, right? And I love prospects.
You know, some of them are gonna miss.
Some of them are gonna miss, and you can't just hoard them forever.
Right.
Like, you have to turn them into currency at some point, right? If you're Chris Antonetti, you already have one of the most valuable rotations in baseball behind the Nationals and some other teams, perhaps. But you already have a really strong rotation. You're incredibly deep at middle infield. You're actually getting pretty deep in the outfield because you've got guys like Tyler Holt and James Ramsey and Tyler Naquin and Bradley Zimmer and on and on, right? I'm not saying I would do it.
But it could be entertained, I guess.
But if you're going to, and I understand me completely. If you're the Nationals, you're not trading Strasburg for something that doesn't involve Lindor. And right. If I'm the Indians, I don't know if I want to trade Lindor even for Steven Strasburg. But if I'm going to ever consider it, Steven Strasburg's the kind of person I'm going to consider it for.
Yes, it would have to be, yeah, for that caliber of player.
Right. Because could you imagine a rotation of Corey Kluber, Steven Strasburg, Carlos Carrasco, Trevor Bauer, and Danny Salazar?
You can imagine. One can imagine.
I'm just saying.
Yeah, I think I'm kind of with your general sentiment that I don't know that I would necessarily do it if I were Cleveland. But I mean, Lindor is the kind of player that gets a deal done like that if you need to.
Right. It's something to think about.
And you heard it here, Tribe fans.
When you're about to fall asleep tonight. Listen, there's as much credence to this rumor that I just started as that James Shields to the Indians rumor.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Hey, listen, we're not tweeting stuff out going, Indians, potential suitors for Strasburg, ? Yeah, we're just two schlubs in our basements talking about baseball and how that trade could potentially work out, I suppose.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I guess I'll keep my fingers crossed for you, I guess, ish. I don't know. I mean, I want to see Lindor in Cleveland, though. I'm invested in Lindor, Jason. I have an autographed bat from Francisco Lindor.
The truth comes out.
I'm going to be disappointed if I don't get to go see Francisco Lindor at the Jake. So I'm just putting it out there.
I don't think you have to worry about that.
I hope not. Yeah, it's going to be hard for me to get an autographed Steven Strasburg bat. So, you want to talk about the Pirates and the Indians?
Especially when he plays in the American League.
Yeah. man. Yeah. So you want to talk Pirates Indians now that we're done talking about the Nationals?
Yeah, yeah.
And pretend
let's
things.
Do that.
So let's start by talking about the Pittsburgh Pirates. Really, I shouldn't say we're going to talk about the Pittsburgh Pirates as much as I should say we're going to talk about how the Pittsburgh Pirates have signed Korean infielder Jung Ho Kang, because the negotiations went on for a while. And last time we recorded, we know that they'd won the posting fee, which was a fairly right. modest posting fee. I was, I guess maybe I got too used to looking at what all these Cuban players were signing for when they were coming over and, how much money they were making up front. And, you look at guys like Dice K, who's, his posting fee was like $50 million or something ridiculous like that. So, in my head, I'm thinking like, posting fee, maybe somewhere around like $7 to $10 million. And it was like I said, it was a very modest $5 million posting fee. It was $5 million and some change.
Right.
For Kang, which I feel like that says you can kind of infer a lot about a lot of things from that posting fee. Number one being clearly not everybody is as high on Kang as we may have been led to believe.
Right.
I'm not shocked that Pittsburgh won. I'm shocked that Pittsburgh won for only $5 million. That kind of tells you a lot. Other teams maybe aren't feeling as confident as Pittsburgh is in Kang. And then the other thing that I was kind of surprised by was the value of the contract, because from everything that was coming out in the media that we were reading, the deal that he was seeking was supposedly 4 years and $20 million.
Right.
So you're looking at, an average annual value of $5 million a year. Well, what he ended up signing for was a 4-year, $11 million contract that has a club option at the end, or a buyout in 2019. Coupled with the $5 million posting fee, you're looking at, you got Kang for $16 million for four seasons for an average annual value of $4 million a year, which, not nearly as expensive as I had thought it was going to be in my head based on everything right. I'd read. So I was kind of surprised by that as well. Really, I don't know how you feel about this, but I feel really okay with this deal now. I feel like even if this deal goes bad, it doesn't go like bad. Even if it turns out that Kang can't hit a major league pitcher to save his life, and Pittsburgh is just giving away $4 million. $4 million is not that bad, even for a team like the Pirates.
It's right. I mean, it's not nothing, but it's not Max Scherzer money.
Right. Yeah.
Right. So I think you're fairly protected from like an albatross contract, right? Which is, of course, what you worry about when you're buying something that you don't know what you're getting. On the other hand, what it lacks in dollars, it kind of makes up for in years, because it's not a short commitment.
Right.
You know, yeah. So like you said, if it could be readily apparent by June of next season, not the 2015, but the 2016 season, that he just can't hit in the majors. Which at that point, you know, you've got a couple more years of $4 million to look forward to. At least it's only $4 million, but the contract stretches a little bit. Well, on the other hand, he can play multiple positions. So if he proves to be an adequate defender, $4 million is not that bad. I mean, you can't go out and buy Jamie Carroll for $4 million.
Yeah.
And Jamie Carroll can't hit, and he can, like, adequately play a bunch of positions.
Right. So, I mean, at least with Kong, you have the upside. And, I mean, every time I've been writing an article about him, I've been posting a video of him just destroying a baseball. Right. You know, the power's legit. There's no...
Right.
That's not a question. I mean,
hoping he runs into a couple.
If he runs into a baseball, it's going to travel far.
Right.
But the thing that I was kind of surprised the most about, I guess I would say, about this whole situation was after Kong was signed, I assumed he would be going to at least AAA just to kind of get acclimated to, you know, baseball in the United States and, you know, having to face good pitching every night, but not having to do it in front of 40,000 people. Dan Szymborski, he created the Zips projection system.
Right.
He compared the Korean baseball organization to a hitter friendly version of AA baseball.
Yeah.
So when you think of it in that context, you would think like, well, okay, you know, it's going to take him a little time to get acclimated to playing baseball in the majors. But Neil Huntington came out and stated right away that they have zero intention of starting him in the minors. I was totally shocked by that.
See, I wasn't surprised by that at all. I found it interesting when I read your reaction online that you were shocked, because my feeling, I guess, going in was, if you're going to spend $20 million on someone, you better hope that they don't need to be seasoned in AAA.
Well, let me ask you this. What happens if...
I don't know.
Let's say Neil Walker has a bad back, which is very realistic because Neil Walker has a bad back.
This is very realistic so far. Very likely.
And suddenly, Pittsburgh has this hole at second base that they attempt to fill with Kong. So Kong's going to have to play for 2 weeks while Neil Walker sits in a jacuzzi stretching out his back, getting himself back in game form. So 2 weeks of Kong at second base. And after 2 weeks, he's just struggling like crazy. He's hitting 100, no home runs, not driving in any runs.
I can see it.
This happens, right? So two weeks, he's just awful. And then, you know, Neil Walker comes back, and then you got to bounce Kong around the infield. So you're starting him at third a little bit to give Josh Harrison some days off, starting him at short a little bit, trying to get some days off there. And he's still struggling. But you're committed. You've already said you're not sending him to the minors. Now, do you backpedal on that and say, like, well, maybe we do need to send him down there? Or do you just leave him to flounder on your roster, taking up space that you could be using to have someone else who's productive in there? That's what...
Well...
It's Neil Huntington very, very rarely deals in absolutes. Very rarely does Neil Huntington say, like, oh, yeah, this is the way it has to be. Like, it's very rare you hear him say that. And so I guess I was just taken aback by the fact that he said we have zero intention of that happening, because that's a very absolute thing to say. Like, what if he comes to spring training as just garbage all spring training? You're going to say, like, well, yeah, but it's okay. Don't worry. It's just spring training.
He left himself an out there. He said they have zero intention.
So you're digging into this attorney style. And you're saying that's...
He said, hey, it's not what we wanted to do, but, you know.
You're saying that's how he digs himself out of this hole that he's put himself in?
I'm saying if the situation you described occurs, I think they're going to be getting a lot of pressure to send him to AAA. I don't know if he sends him. I mean, there's a million factors in that. You know what I mean? Like, if Gregory Polanco is struggling too, and it's like, oh, you know, we don't have a good fourth outfielder because you're losing this roster spot for Kong, and, you know, blah 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 blah, or so and so has a, you know, sore tummy in the bullpen, but we don't want to put him on the disabled list, and we're losing a roster spot for Kong. Like, those kind of things are how I see him getting sent to the minors, like part of this complex organizational situation. You know what I mean?
Right.
I think, like you said, he's being, you know, at least for Neil Huntington, pretty absolute with that statement. So unless there's some goofy situation like that, yeah, he's making it sound like he's not sending him to the minors, which to me makes me think that they're going to ride this baby out all year. And they're just going to keep pointing to those pinch hit home runs that he runs into against, you know, Arthur Rhodes or somebody.
Right.
And be like, see? See?
Which, I mean, if that's what you're trying to get out of him, that I understand. But, you know, if he's struggling to the point where he's not providing you any offensive value anywhere, I have a real hard time imagining, especially if Pittsburgh wants to remain competitive. I mean, you can't just take up a roster spot with a guy who's, you know,
so
clearly
bad.
Underdeveloped, or, you know, whatever word that you want to use for it. Because there's really no way to compare. We don't have any... You know, Pittsburgh is really just kind of dipping their toes in that Korean market as far as hitters go. You know, there's no way to compare what numbers in Korea mean relative to what numbers in North America mean.
Right. Which is, we talked about this last time, which is one of the reasons why I think that they got him for a cheap posting fee, because nobody knows.
Right.
You know, it's like guys like Yasiel Puig and these guys have proven that the top level of talent from Cuba can stick, but we haven't seen that much of a sample size from this league.
Right.
If any.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, like I said, I feel good about the deal. $4 million, that's Jose Tabata money that, you know, you can absorb that if you need to.
Isn't he in the minors?
Yeah. Yeah. There were some very interesting articles from people in the know about Jose Tabata and how his style of play were received in the clubhouse by Clint Hurdle.
Oh, I see.
And from my understanding, it's not favorably. So
I'm getting that impression.
yeah. But so I don't know. Like I said, if he turns into I think when I wrote the article originally, I compared him to, you know, if he had a season comparable to Brad Miller, you know, last year in 2014, that's a good season. You know, if he goes out there and he's being put in situations where he can succeed in his limited playing time, because at this point that's just kind of looking what it's going to be like. You know, if he goes out there and he hits 10 home runs and hits 240, yeah. I mean, that's good value for Pittsburgh. You know, we don't need him to go out there and have like an OPS plus a 120 or something. You know, we just need you to go out there and be right around average.
I mean, that's pretty much what Zach Walters was for the Indians last year. Like, he could play like three or four different places. He struck out a ton. He only hit like, I don't know, 230, 240, but he hit like 10 home runs in like just a couple months.
Yeah.
Because when he made contact, oh, man.
Watch out.
When he didn't make contact, you know, people had to put their coats on. So, yeah. I mean, if that's what you get, you know, then it's all right. And who knows? Maybe you get more than that.
Right. Yeah.
It's an interesting insurance policy because you don't really know what you have with Josh Harrison. You don't really know what you have with Jordy Mercer, and you don't really know how healthy Neil Walker is going to be.
Right, and that was one of the things I wrote in the last article about Kong, was I said, you know, while Kong has his own question marks, so does literally every single person in the infield.
Yeah.
You know, going from first base all the way around the horn. So, I mean, he's going to have opportunities to play, whether it's from some crazy injury to Neil Walker or, you know, just guys needing days off, or Josh Harrison ending up not being an MVP candidate, or whatever.
I can't see that happening.
Bite your tongue, Jason. Bite your tongue. So that's pretty much all I wanted to talk about with Pittsburgh. So what's going on in Tribe Town? There's really not much going on in Tribe Town. So let me rephrase that, Jason. What do you want to talk about with the Cleveland Indians today?
Yeah, I think today we're going to talk about the Zips projections for the Indians, because there's not much to talk about.
Yeah.
I don't think literally anything has happened since we last spoke in regards to the Indians. Terry Francona did say in a pseudo-absolute, like Neil Huntington, that Francisco Lindor is not going to make the team out of spring training, so you can just forget about that right now.
So everybody calm down.
But yeah, I mean, there's not much happening. There was the James Shields rumor, which we talked about how ridiculous that was a little bit. And then there was a real rumor that I can actually believe, is that they were looking for late inning relief help that didn't cost a lot. Yep, that sounds like the Indians.
Aren't we all?
That sounds like them. So let's talk about the Zips projections a little.
Well, can we preface this a little bit, maybe for some of our our audience members who aren't statistically inclined?
Go ahead.
I mentioned earlier that Zips was a system developed by Dan Szymborski, but just so everyone's kind of familiar, Zips is this big, crazy algorithmic thing that it takes players' past statistics, their age, the ballpark in which they play, and like just tons of crazy variables, and this system estimates how well they think a player is going to perform in the upcoming season based on all that information.
Right.
So,
and it,
you know,
doesn't usually estimate playing time.
Right. And there's all kinds of stuff that, you know, obviously Zips can't account for, like, you know, like a crazy BABIP, or, you know, like a player getting injured or a player getting traded or something like that. Right. So, you know, like, there's obviously a lot of stuff that you can't account for.
Right. Like that, for example, Clint Frazier will not sniff the Indians this year, but in their projection for him, it's for 505 plate appearances.
Right.
So it's just kind of taking things into account of if they played or, you know, got this many appearances or pitched this many innings, we're not getting into the real situation of the roster, but if this occurred, what do we project they would do?
Right. Yep.
So it creates some interesting ones to look at.
Yeah.
For example, Zach Walters, who Zips projects, if he got 492 plate appearances, would hit 24 home runs and 24 doubles, but would bat a whopping 233, which seems about right. But as far as guys that we actually care about, of course, after his, you know, top three finish in the MVP voting and his Silver Slugger Award and his tremendous season, when I started looking through this, my eyes immediately went to Michael Brantley. Just because I think it's interesting, Michael Brantley seems to have developed into something that a lot of scouts didn't imagine. A guy with more power, a guy with a higher batting average than they predicted. So it's, you know, I wanted to see what they predicted for Brantley. And they had him racking up 651 plate appearances, which is a whopper. 175 hits, 13 homers, 84 RBI. So they have him come down a little on the homers, which is probably not too hard to believe. A nice healthy 18 steals and a whopping 37 doubles. If Michael Brantley hit 37 doubles this year, I would be very happy. And they also have him hitting 297 with a 352 on base. Woo. So that would be nice to see.
Yeah, it would.
Carlos Santana, they have batting 249 with a 367 on base, which is probably pretty realistic.
Yeah.
Also, 15.5% walk rate against an 18.5% strikeout rate, which again, that sounds like Carlos. you might be interested for what they predict for Jason Kipnis after last year's disaster of a season.
I am. My fantasy team is very interested as well.
Mine too. They have him pretty healthy. He's playing or getting 600 plus plate appearances. 13 homers, 68 RBI, 25 steals, and 28 doubles while batting 256 with a 330 on base.
256, huh?
So they dropped his power numbers a little, and they left his average a little on the low side. So it's not a full, you know, quote-unquote bounce back, but it's much improved from last year.
Yeah.
Now, here's the one I was interested in, because Lonnie Chisenhall, a tremendous first half and a pretty rough second half.
Yeah, it turned out he was a regular person in the second half.
Yeah, so of course it's interesting to see, you know, Lonnie's had a pretty short major league career, had only about 2 or 3 months of lighting the world on fire during that time. They have him batting 271 with a 325 on base, which is about right for Lonnie's plate discipline or lack of.
Yeah.
And they have him at 14 homers and 59 RBIs with 26 doubles. So that's, I mean, honestly, that's, I don't think that's crazy for Lonnie Chisenhall.
No, I think that's a good season.
That's a good season. I wouldn't even be upset if the average was a little below that.
Right.
I think that would still be a quality season. Who else do you want to know?
Who haven't we hit on yet? Well, just why don't you tell me about Lindor, just because I'm curious what they would say.
They got him for 552 plate appearances, 17 doubles, 4 triples, 11 homers, 49 RBIs, and 19 steals.
Double-digit homers.
Yeah, I don't know about that. Batting 244 with a 294 on base, 358 slugging.
I can deal with those numbers. So,
I mean, if you're a rookie, that's nothing to be ashamed of.
No.
That's a good start to a career, I'd say.
What about now, what about our boy Jose Ramirez?
I knew that you were going to say that. That's what I was just pulling up. So conversely, for Jose, who does have a little bit of major league experience to go off of, it's about the same plate appearances, 23 doubles, 4 triples, 7 home runs, 47 RBIs, 27 steals.
Ooh, they like that speed.
263 batting average, 304 on base, and a 360 slugging. So, a similar player, honestly.
Yeah.
A very similar player.
I'm going to be honest. I thought Ramirez's power numbers would sound a lot like Lindor's. I was surprised they had Lindor at 11 home runs.
I'm surprised they have him at 11 home runs, too. That seems a little high to me. If I gave you the over-under for Nick Swisher's batting average...
Oh, boy.
And I put it at 240.
I was just about to say 242 would be my...
Take the over?
I would take the over, but just barely.
Zips has him at 229.
Ooh. What do they have his on-base percentage at?
316. Same as David Murphy.
Oh, wow. 229.
That's brutal.
They are not very high on Mr. Swisher, huh?
They also have Brandon Moss batting 236.
What are the rest of Moss's numbers look like, though?
On base of 321, so almost 100 points higher. Slugging of 475, which is probably... pretty nice.
Yeah, that's a great slugging percentage.
28 homers and 77 ribbies. 22 doubles.
I would feel great about that season.
If he hit 28 homers, I'll take a 230.
Yeah. Plus, you know what I say about the measure of a good season, Jason. What do I say about your on-base percentage?
Well, it should be, 100 points above your batting average would be amazing.
Yeah, that's a good, that's what Carlos Santana does every season.
Right.
So, if you're hitting 230, but you're getting on base at a 330 clip.
That's all right.
You're having a good season.
You're getting on base one out of every three times you get up to the plate.
Yeah, we can tolerate that.
We can deal with that. How about we'll just do one more. We don't want to bore people with this for too long. What if we'll take... the over-under on Michael Bourne's batting average at 250.
At 250. I'm going to say over.
257.
Okay. Yeah, I was going to say 262 was the number I had in my head.
Yeah. But going off of what you just said, his on-base percentage is 313. Not 100 points
higher. No, not 100 points higher. But he's also not that caliber of player. People aren't scared to pitch to Michael Bourne.
Sure. So if I gave you the over-under on Michael Bourne's steals projected by Zips, and I gave you 20, under. Which keep in mind is like a far cry from what he used to do.
Yeah, I'm definitely going under on that.
You're going under?
I would say 17.
They're going 22. They're going to take the over.
Ooh. All right, so they still got a little faith in those legs.
I'd be very happy if he stole 22 bases.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yan Gomes, by the way, it's almost exactly the same as last season.
Which you got to feel great about that.
It's a very, very strong season from Yan Gomes. So, yeah, other than dreaming about Zips projections... there's not a whole lot going on. I guess we didn't do any pitchers, did we?
No, we didn't.
Well, I'm not going to go through the pitcher stats because there's so many of them. It can be kind of overwhelming. But I will give you the projected WAR for the rotation. How about that?
Let's hear it. I'm kind of curious about Carlos Carrasco myself.
Gavin Floyd, projected WAR, 0.
All right. Off to a good start.
Trevor Bauer, 1.
Okay.
Carlos Carrasco, 1. Danny Salazar, 2. Corey Kluber, 5.
Ooh, that's quite the jump there.
Yeah, if you read the article on Fangraphs that was written by Carson Cistulli that goes on and explains a little bit of what's happening, he basically says, you know, Zips isn't sure how to handle Carlos Carrasco because he spent so much time in the bullpen and he's had, you know, some good times as a starter, some bad times, some amazing times as a starter. So
yeah,
he's basically saying that's why you get that projection. So I think that about wraps it up.
I agree, Jason. I think that is going to wrap us up for today. So for our listeners, you can check us out on the web at www.tsmbaseball.com. You can email us, tristatebb@tsmbaseball.com. You can follow us on the Twitter at TriStateBB, and you can check us out on Facebook at facebook.com/TSMBaseball. So for Jason Ruggiero, this is Andy Burdick, and we look forward to talking to you soon.